5. Dangerous liaisons. The idea for the experiment sprang out of a casual conversation. Janice Moore had been invited to give a talk on parasitic manipulators at the State University of New York at Binghamton. The day before the event, Chris Reiber, a biological anthropologist there, had picked her up at the airport as a favor for another colleague and invited her back to her home for dinner. Reiber didn't know Moore or her research very well, so as she prepared food, she peppered her with questions. Hearing Moore's stories about manipulators in nature immediately made Reiber think of sexually transmitted diseases in people. Before coming to Binghamton, she'd had a job at a neuropsychiatric institute at UCLA that worked closely with nearby clinics treating patients with HIV. The clinic directors used to tell me that HIV-positive patients go through these terrible end-stage phases where they had intense cravings for sex, Reiber told me. These were anecdotal reports and not well documented, but she'd started to wonder if they might have a basis in fact, because when she attended scientific conferences, other health professionals shared similar stories. Maybe, she suggested to Moore, these urges, if true, were the virus's attempt to spread before the host's imminent death. It was an interesting notion, Moore agreed, but there was no way to prove it without doing something no one would dream of. Infecting healthy people. You had to be able to compare behavior before and after the exposure to make a strong case, she said. So how would you explore this in humans? Reiber pressed her. Soon the two scientists were batting around ideas about other types of microbes that might want to manipulate us, germs that would be safer to study. What about a cold virus? Maybe it makes you more social in order to fan its spread. Why not expose people to a mild cold virus? But again, they nixed the plan as too tricky. Then Moore got an inspiration. Doctors give people the flu all the time, she said. By that, she meant they gave them flu vaccines, which contained all the same molecules found in the live virus, except for its dangerous infectious component. Moore hypothesized that the inactivated flu virus in the vaccine would induce the same behavioral changes in its human hosts as its untamed twin did. Checking people's social habits before and after receiving the vaccine, they both agreed, might be a relatively easy and ethical way to show that parasites manipulate humans, overcoming a major criticism of Phlegra's studies of people, the oft-repeated charge that correlation does not establish causation. After Moore returned home, the two scientists began exploring in earnest how they might conduct the trial. Delving into the medical literature, they discovered that the flu virus is most transmittable in the 2 to 3 days after a person's exposure to it, but prior to the onset of symptoms. Indeed, viral shedding peaked during that narrow window of time. Put another way, if you go to a party and wake up the next morning with a sore throat and runny nose, don't assume the people you hugged or shook hands with the night before gave you the bug. Quite likely, just the opposite happened. You gave it to them. Once you begin coughing and blowing your nose, you'll probably take to your bed and lie low, providing the pathogen with fewer chances to meet new people. By then, your immune system will have kicked into gear, squelching the virus's ambition. Putting this all together, Moore and Reiber predicted that the germ would prod people to seek out the company of others early in the infection, before it had blown its cover and triggered a counterattack by defense cells. Once they'd formulated a hypothesis, they decided it would be wise to conduct a pilot trial to see if the idea had any merit. The researchers tracked the social interactions of 36 people, none of whom knew the purpose of the study, before and after they got flu shots at a health clinic on the Binghamton campus. The change in the subject's behavior was huge, so notable that its magnitude surprised even Reiber and Moore. In the first 3 days after vaccination, coinciding with the time when the virus was most contagious, subjects interacted with twice as many people as they had before being inoculated. People who had very limited or simple social lives were suddenly deciding that they needed to go out to bars or parties or invite a bunch of people over, reported Reiber. This happened with lots of our subjects. It wasn't just one or two oddities. Unfortunately, like many scientists with exciting early findings, they never did succeed in getting the funding to do a larger trial, which would have included a control group that got a sham vaccine. Until that happens, they can't rule out an alternative explanation for their dramatic results. People who get vaccinated may mingle more because, as Moore puts it, they perceive themselves as bulletproof, that is, immune to infections. The idea that pathogens responsible for STDs stoke sexual appetites also remains unproven, but Reiber and Moore aren't alone in harboring such suspicions. On a blog sponsored by the University of Chicago Press for the purpose of promoting the free exchange of ideas between luminaries and science, the Columbia virologist Ian Lipkin wrote, "It is possible, though I have no experimental proof, that when herpes simplex virus infects the sacral ganglia, nerves at the base of the spine, it may inadvertently stimulate nerve endings in the pelvic area, promoting sexual activity and increasing the likelihood it will move into another host." In a more recent conversation with me, Reiber speculated that when the herpes virus awakens from its dormant phase to cause genital blisters, it may do more than just rev up someone's libido. As part of its reproductive strategy, it may also fuel his or her desire to have sex with different partners. Like Lipkin, she has no data to support that view, but given the remarkably broad range of talents displayed by manipulative parasites, it's a hypothesis, in her opinion, that bears consideration. At the University of Montpellier, Frederick Thomas raised yet another possibility. A parasite doesn't need to increase your motivation for sex, because most animals have plenty of motivation. At first opportunity, they act on it. The problem is to increase your attractiveness when you're most infectious. According to him, as women approach the fertile period of the menstrual cycle, there's evidence that their voices become more animated, lilting and slightly breathless, which makes them seem more excited and engaged in a conversation, a come-on to the opposite sex. I wouldn't be surprised if parasites are doing something similar. Weirdly, an infectious agent not traditionally thought of as an STD, the rabies virus, can trigger sudden shifts in libido. A sharp rise in sexual craving, arousal, and pleasure are atypical but well-documented manifestations of the disease in humans. In earlier centuries, the French referred to these uncontrollable desires in women as la rage amoureuse and la fureur uterine. Men may experience prolonged erections and ejaculations as often as hourly, sometimes accompanied by orgasms, symptoms so dramatic that they were noted even in the ancient world. The Greek physician Galen in the 2nd century recounted that a porter in the throes of rabies had multiple involuntary emissions over 3 days. Of course, rabid animals can't tell us how they're feeling, but prolonged erections are similarly a sign of the disease in dogs, who may begin furiously humping anything in their path. Since no discussion of neuroparasitology would be complete without addressing rabies, let's take a closer look at what the virus does. The fact that an infection spread by bare-fanged aggression can occasionally excite the loins certainly gives rabies a lurid appeal. But there is a more pressing reason the disease deserves our attention. Although those blessed to live in societies with excellent healthcare often think of rabies as a scourge of the past, the disease remains at epidemic levels in poorer parts of Africa, Asia, and elsewhere. A familiarity with the ravages of rabies will make you profoundly grateful for the efforts of every researcher who's worked to prevent the disease, all the way back to Louis Pasteur, who in 1885 harvested saliva from the fangs of a rabid dog in order to develop the first vaccine. Before then, the only treatment for the much-feared infection consisted of cauterizing the site of an animal's bite or amputating a mauled foot, hand, or limb. Such drastic measures often worked, owing to the pathogen's slow mechanism of action. After entering through pierced skin, it doesn't infiltrate the bloodstream, the modus operandi of almost every other virus. Instead, it creeps along the nerve fibers, moving at a plodding pace of a few inches a day, until it reaches the brain, usually about 2 to 4 weeks later. Though, baffling scientists, the incubation period can in some instances stretch for many months or even a year or more. For most people, the first symptom is a flu-like malaise, an indication that the infection has reached the brain. In short course, the virus typically invades the limbic system, a neural center that controls such fundamental drives as aggression, sex, hunger, and thirst. This is when victims may experience momentous sexual stirrings. As the virus madly replicates, causing circuits to fire erratically, light, noise, a scent, or the slightest touch, even a breeze, can trigger profound agitation. This phenomenon, called hyperesthesia, may have a purpose in common hosts like dogs, raccoons, bats, and foxes. An excitable animal is easily provoked to snap its jaws. The virus also paralyzes muscles in the throat. When people cry out in pain, they emit hoarse choking sounds, sometimes likened to a bark. As swallowing becomes more difficult, saliva rich in the infectious agent builds up in the mouth and becomes frothy, spilling over the lip in long threads of drool. Hydrophobia, literally fear of water, often seizes hold of human victims at this point. Fear, however, doesn't adequately describe the torment water evokes in the afflicted. Because the virus causes extremely painful contractions of the throat, the sight of any liquid in a glass or splashing in a basin can actually elicit a gag response. As the disease progresses to the so-called furious phase, victims' expressions may assume a menacing grimace as facial muscles go into involuntary spasms. Unlike rabid animals, people rarely bite, but they may fly into a rage. Terrifying hallucinations are not uncommon at this stage. Death usually occurs a few days after the onset of severe symptoms, typically due to asphyxiation or cardiac arrest. The disease does not always take such a dramatic course, however. In a third of cases, inexplicably, the sole manifestation of the infection is paralysis, which starts at the site of the bite and gradually spreads throughout the body, leading to coma and death. This is a less violent but usually slower path to the grave, so it has the drawback of prolonging suffering. As unnerving as the symptoms are, perhaps more unsettling is the fact that this pathogen doesn't need to turn its hosts into savage beasts in order to spread. Before an infected animal begins behaving bizarrely, the virus has already reached high concentrations in its saliva and can be spread when the creature licks specific parts of another animal's body, notably the smooth pink mucous membranes that line the eyes, lips, mouth, nostrils, nipples, anus, and genitals. The virus is affecting its transmission by normal mammalian behavior, said rabies expert Charles Ruprecht. We're social. We love to lick, we love to suck, we love to bite. Sucking is part of the maternal bond. Most mammals are doing a lot of genital licking and sniffing. Dogs do that all the time. Puppies jump up and do play biting because they're trying to be fed by the mom. During copulation, a male will bite a female on the nape of the neck to subdue her. We're all keyed up on the peculiar things the virus does to us, but by and large, they're inconsequential to its spread. Fortunately for us, we are not as susceptible to the virus as other mammals are. The chances of human-to-human transmission of the virus, for example, through oral sex, kissing, or a love bite, are remote. The few cases that have been reported are anecdotal and come from poor countries where health officials don't have the resources to prevent the disease, much less conduct carefully controlled epidemiological studies to determine the veracity of such claims. Still, Ruprecht is adamant that anyone who's had sex with a person with rabies, or even shared a cigarette or a drink with him or her, should be given prophylactic treatment. Typically a series of 4 injections in the arm, which, contrary to myth, are no more painful than ordinary flu shots. Based on everything we understand about the pathophysiology of this disease, it's certainly feasible that individuals can be transmitting rabies by kissing and oral sex, he underscored. Since a sharp rise in libido can be one of the infection's earliest symptoms, moreover, there is the danger that a rabid person may unwittingly spread the virus before he or she is diagnosed. In a case reported in India, for example, a 28-year-old married woman suddenly wanted sex so often that it became a source of marital stress, leading her to consult a gynecologist and another physician, and ultimately go to an emergency room. There she developed hydrophobia, causing the doctors caring for her to immediately suspect rabies. When questioned, she recalled that 2 months earlier, a puppy had given her a tiny bite that seemed insignificant at the time. She died in the ER the next day, but her husband was vaccinated and did not get rabies. In a given milliliter of saliva, there's probably upwards of 1 million virions, virus particles, said Ruprecht. For a disease with the highest fatality of any infectious agent, who's going to take that risk? I can't treat you for rabies once you're ill. In sum, the rabies virus appears to improve its transmission by essentially bludgeoning the brain, causing numerous circuits to go haywire all at once. Some of the symptoms it includes, for example, hydrophobia, appear to be irrelevant to its spread, but heightening sexual arousal may be useful, at least in animals. Certainly inciting an animal to bite by stirring up rage and hyperesthesia, jangling its nerves in response to the least sensation, are methods it uses most effectively for host hopping. Nonetheless, the fact that rabies can be transmitted before symptoms emerge by a friendly lick or nip on the neck during normal sexual coupling suggests the furious stage in reality serves as an insurance policy. In essence, the parasite's backup plan for finding a new host should it fail to get around by more mundane means. That's the modern take on rabies. In earlier times, before anyone knew about viruses or how they spread, people no doubt saw the disease as a contagious madness. A savage beast bites you, and through the wound, its spirit enters your body. Thus possessed, you too become a wild animal. You foam at the mouth, rage at the world, and may even, in your delirium, bite. You bark like a dog and display uncontrolled carnality. Violence, sex, blood, and gore. An evil that spreads and has a life of its own. If that profile sounds familiar, it's because rabies almost certainly provides the foundation for vampire myths. In many of these legends, especially versions originating in Eastern Europe in the first half of the 18th century, vampires are people, including sometimes the deceased, who rise at night and, often taking the form of a dog or wolf, violate their neighbors, gorging on their flesh, sucking their blood, or raping them, among other heinous acts. Actually, these were not just stories to people living at that time. They were believed to be true, and anyone accused of having such savage powers could be hanged or burned at the stake. Count Dracula, penned into existence by Bram Stoker in 1897, built on these ancient accounts, except that his villain famously morphs into a bat. It is surely no accident that these supernatural forms possessed the viciousness and hypersexuality of rabid animals and wore the mantle of rabies' most common hosts, or that vampirism, like the viral disease, can be transmitted by a bite. Nor does the resemblance stop there. In an article published in 1998 in the normally staid pages of Neurology, the Spanish physician Juan Gomez Alonso pointed out other, less obvious parallels between vampires and rabid animals. According to folklore, the lifespan of a vampire was 40 days, which coincides with the average time a victim lives after being bitten by a rabid animal. And just like rabid people, vampires were repelled by light, hence their nocturnal habits. Strong smells, the odor of garlic, according to folktales, could warn them off. And water. Pouring it around graves was recommended to keep them in their underground vaults. We've explored the thesis that parasitic manipulators may take advantage of our sociality and sex drive. Let's now look at a parasite that might threaten our minds in a very different way. It's not as garish or nightmarish as rabies by any stretch. What makes it concerning to scientists, in fact, is its stealth. They fear it could be quietly eroding the intellect of infected people. And it, too, can be transmitted to us by our cherished pets. That parasite is Toxocara. For those of us who love dogs or cats or both, it may be thought of as Toxoplasma's evil twin. A 6-inch long worm, Toxocara comes in two species, Toxocara canis and Toxocara cati, which, as their names suggest, infect dogs and cats respectively. A strong clue that Toxocara could spell mental trouble for us is the fact that the parasite's larvae can become lodged in the human brain. At least the canis variety has been shown to do that. Less is known about the T. cati species, which may not have as strong an affinity for the brain. An estimated 10 to 30% of people in North America and Europe are infected with the worm's larvae, and as much as 40% of the populations of some poor countries. With numbers like that, you'd think the medical literature would be overflowing with papers exploring its effects on human mental and physical health. But Toxocara appears on the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's list of the top 5 neglected parasitic diseases, and experts commonly use words like cryptic and enigmatic to describe it. Why the snub? Decades ago, the parasite fell off doctors' radar screens because, unlike T. gondii, the infection is much less likely to cause serious disease. Parasitologists, in contrast, have long been wary of Toxocara. At Trinity College, Dublin, Ireland, Celia Holland, a leading investigator of the pathogen, worries that it's causing subtle cognitive deficits that have long been overlooked. Toxocara is better known to pet owners as roundworm, those pale, yellow, wriggling threads that dogs and cats sometimes cough up, or that are passed in their stools along with thousands of the parasite's microscopic eggs. When the eggs are consumed by another dog or cat, they develop into fast-moving larvae that invade many different organs of the body. Those that reach the gut hatch into worms and begin pumping out eggs, repeating the cycle. The infection is also passed down from one generation of animals to the next, for the larvae that stay behind in other tissues are activated when a female becomes pregnant, at which time they may cross her placenta or pass into her milk, invading her litter. Roundworms spread to other hosts in much the same way as T. gondii. The eggs may be picked up by rodents, rabbits, moles, birds, and other small creatures that in turn may appeal to canine or feline taste buds, providing yet another route by which the parasite can get back to its spawning ground inside our pets' guts. Livestock can also consume the eggs, so people may become exposed to the larvae by eating undercooked meat. The most common way we come in contact with the parasite, however, is by poor hygiene. Most vulnerable in that regard are young children playing in the dirt or in sandboxes contaminated with cat or dog feces. When Toxocara eggs hatch into larvae inside a human body, they do not grow into adult worms. That can happen only in a canine or feline host. Instead, the parasite's development remains arrested at its highly mobile larval stage, allowing it to wander far beyond the gut to organs such as the liver, lungs, eyes, and occasionally, no one knows how often given the dearth of research, the brain. In keeping with the parasite's reputation for being innocuous, blindness, seizures, and other severe neurological symptoms are uncommon complications of the infection. But starting as far back as the 1980s, clues began to surface in the medical literature that it might be destructive in more devious ways. In an early study conducted by Holland and physician Mervyn Taylor in Ireland, 200 children who had tested positive for the parasite were divided into 3 groups based on levels of antibodies, a measure of the severity of the infection. Behavioral disturbances, headaches, and disrupted sleep, along with 20 other physical symptoms ranging from asthma to stomach pain, all increased in direct proportion to the youngsters' antibody levels. Other small studies, including 2 carried out in the United States, compared the cognitive skills of infected children with those free of it. Worse outcomes, for instance, lower academic performance, hyperactivity, and heightened distractibility, were reported in the infected children. And an epidemiological survey conducted in France, the only one to Holland's knowledge that is focused on an older age group, connected the infection to a higher risk of dementia. All these studies had only a few hundred subjects each, making it impossible to draw firm conclusions from them. What's more, Toxocara disproportionately affects the poor, so socioeconomic factors muddied interpretation of the evidence. In short, this smattering of data, while concerning, was hardly persuasive. A study published in 2012, however, rigorously controlled for those confounding variables, and it bore out Holland's suspicions. The report, which appeared in the International Journal for Parasitology, was based on an analysis of a huge body of epidemiological data collected in the United States by the CDC. Its authors used a battery of psychometric tests to assess the cognitive functioning of a nationally representative sample of almost 4,000 youngsters from 6 to 16 years old, roughly half of whom tested positive for the parasite. Compared to age-matched controls, the infected kids got significantly lower scores on every measure, including mathematical ability, reading comprehension, verbal digit recall, visuospatial reasoning, and IQ. Impressing Holland, the study's results held up even after the researchers controlled for socioeconomic status, education, ethnicity, gender, and most important, blood levels of lead, whose toxic effects on the nervous system are well known to depress children's performance at school. The survey also revealed that Toxocara's toll is far from evenly distributed among ethnic groups. 23% of African American children were infected, in contrast to 13% of Mexican Americans and 11% of whites. This implies that disadvantaged minorities may do worse at school, not only because of well-known factors like poor nutrition and inferior education, but also, possibly, because of parasites in their heads. Or so believes Michael Walsh, an epidemiologist at the State University of New York Downstate in Brooklyn, and the lead author of the study. Like Holland, Walsh was drawn to Toxocara research because of the infection's neglected status. "The parasite that makes headlines," he said, "typically are big killers or are gross to look at and make sensational pictures in films. No one pays much attention to the ones that act slowly and stealthily and whose symptoms are less dramatic." While these infectious agents may not maim or murder, they can often harm far more people by keeping their nasty doings hidden. And if the population they target is underprivileged, with poor access to healthcare, the culprits can easily go undetected. Toxocara's connection to poverty is multifold. The risk of soiled objects being placed in the mouth increases when children are unsupervised, a situation more common in low-income families, for whom childcare is a luxury. A trip to a vet to get a pet dewormed can also be too costly for those on tight budgets. Making matters worse, playgrounds and green spaces are rare in run-down inner-city areas, and hence prone to becoming heavily contaminated with dog feces infested with the eggs. Poor rural settings aren't safe from the infection either. Stray dogs and cats are frequently infested with roundworms, and they live close to people who often feed them. So backyards in such areas can also become major repositories of Toxocara eggs. Neither Walsh nor Holland present their findings as definitive. As Walsh explained, "We are just waking up to the fact that maybe this isn't such a benign parasite after all. We're in a very similar situation to investigators who were looking at cognitive harm posed by lead in decades past. Once a common ingredient of paint, lead has insidious long-term health effects, though doctors for years overlooked the danger that confronted children who ingested paint chips or inhaled the powdery residue that old paint sheds as it weathers and cracks. Yet the hazard was far from trivial. Even very low doses were shown to retard cognitive development and depress IQ. It's too soon to say if Toxocara is exacting a similar toll in lost intellectual capacity. At this stage," said Walsh, "we're just looking at what on average is happening to the 4,000 kids in the study. Some children's immune systems will likely be able to eradicate the infection or prevent the larvae from proliferating in the brain," he believes. "In other kids, the immune system may not function as well, or they could be re-exposed to the eggs multiple times while playing outside. Toxocara in those youngsters," he said, "might depress cognitive development far more substantially." Paralleling the findings of studies of children, Mice fed the worm's eggs typically display difficulties learning new tasks compared to those free of the parasite. For example, Holland found that they drank less from a water bottle hidden in a maze that they'd previously navigated, suggesting that their memory was impaired. Yet they were clearly thirsty, for they were keen to drink when they were returned to their cages. And even though infected animals were as active as controls, they appeared less curious. They didn't show as much interest in novel stimuli or exploring their surroundings, essential traits for staying alive in the wild. Inspired by Joanne Webster's famous fatal feline attraction experiments, Holland ran trials to assess how animals infected with Toxocara behaved in situations in which they were at high risk for predation, for instance, when they were placed in an area treated with cat odor or in a brightly lit space. Her results were murky, not a slam dunk as in the case of Webster's toxoplasma findings. An examination of the brain tissue of infected rodents yielded more insights. In the process of attacking the roundworm larvae, their immune systems appeared to be damaging surrounding tissue. And that self-inflicted injury, she suspects, might be responsible for the memory impairment of the infected animals. But there were also hints that the worm's larvae might be capable of the kind of subtle mischief that is a hallmark of a manipulator. The larvae tended to accumulate in the white matter of the mouse's brain, especially in two regions involved in learning and memory. That suggests the parasite may benefit from meddling in those regions and fits well with the observation that infected mice had impaired recall and were less interested in exploring, reducing their familiarity with their surroundings. The parasite wants to get into the final host, and you could argue that some of these effects would definitely make them more vulnerable to predation by a dog or cat, said Holland. Perhaps the best way to settle the argument is to declare the very premise of the debate absurd. As pioneer Janice Moore would remind us, a behavior induced in a host can be the result of both a pathology and a manipulation, so it may be impossible to distinguish one from the other. However the issue is resolved, more research on humans is clearly needed to pin down how often the parasite invades neural tissue and the potential risks, especially to children whose rapidly developing brains are more vulnerable to environmental insults. Unfortunately, there's currently no safe and efficient way to detect the worm's larvae in the brain. A CT scan can indeed visualize them, but it would expose children to harmfully high levels of radiation. An MRI gets around that problem, but that diagnostic method is far less accurate at identifying the larvae. In fact, it's even difficult to isolate them by autopsy, the approach Holland uses in her animal research. She typically spends an hour or more per mouse brain, and that's a mere walnut-sized nugget as opposed to the 3-pound human brain. In spite of that limitation, both Holland and Walsh believe solid research can bring the potential risks of the infection into better focus. One strategy Walsh has proposed is to get a baseline reading of the cognitive functioning of a large group of children who don't have the parasite, and then follow their progress over several years. When some become infected, he'd look to see if their mental ability had deteriorated since their pre-infection assessment, and also in comparison to the youngsters who remained free of the parasite. In the meantime, he's already thinking about ways to counter the parasite's spread in the New York area, which, if successful, might serve as a model for other communities. His first order of business will be to determine where sources of the infection are located. To that end, he hopes to join forces with the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene to embark on an onerous and odorous task: a massive block-by-block survey of dog excrement throughout New York's 5 boroughs. Once problem neighborhoods are identified, the goal would be to target them for interventions, such as encouraging pet owners to be more fastidious about picking up after their dogs, educating them on the importance of deworming their animals, and, perhaps, if evidence continues to incriminate the parasite, even subsidizing the cost of treatment. Antihelminthic medicines, deworming agents, for treating Toxocara are very cheap and can often prevent a dog from becoming infected if given annually in the form of a pill tucked into its chow. To get owners to cooperate with that treatment regimen, One scheme health officials are contemplating is to make the medicine available at pharmacies, at least for prophylactic use, saving people the added cost and inconvenience of a visit to a vet. And of course, if the carrot doesn't work, there's always the stick. Notably, stiffer fines for offenders. To catch violators of pooper scooper laws, sanitation workers might be enlisted as eyes on the ground. Walsh is even thinking about employing social media such as Twitter to get local residents involved in patrolling their neighborhoods. His zeal to purge every pooch of the parasite stems from a stark reality. Treatment of people probably won't reverse the damage done by the parasite. Only, with luck, stop further harm. What else might be toying with our minds? More than 1,400 parasites prey on humans, and that's only the ones we know about. Untold others await discovery. We have no idea how many, already named or still to be christened, may be manipulators. Yet, unsettling as that thought may be, we should not read too much negativity into the unknown. Rapidly accumulating research suggests hordes of microscopic manipulators are everyday residents of our bodies, and they don't all wish us ill by any means. In fact, some, the sort that might more aptly be called symbionts, may actually lift our spirits and offer other mental benefits. How we feel and act matters to them. After all, they have a stake in our survival.